So I invite you to turn to Matthew chapter 16. We are we're working through the rejection narrative. Jesus has had a confrontation with the Pharisees and Sadducees, gone to the Mediterranean coast, and is coming back to Galilee through the region of Syria, the city of Damascus. Mount Hermon is a mountain range that actually divides Syria, divides modern-day Syria and Israel, just as it did in the ancient days. When we went to visit the boundary of Israel and Syria in 2014, our tour guide, David, he said, there are no markers of the boundary between Syria and Israel because Syria does not recognize Israel as a sovereign state. And one of the ladies in the bus said, then what's that? And overnight, the Israelis had constructed a fence that they called a missile screen on the border. Because the border between Syria and Israel is very contested. There are people slipping across it all the time. It's something that you don't hear about in the news when the news media covers Israel's relationship with these other countries. You don't hear about the fact that because these other countries don't recognize Israel, their borders are actually kind of a little bit of a war zone. All of them are. If you were to jump into the Jordan River between Israel and Jordan and try to swim across, the Jordanians would shoot you. There's no fence, there's no barrier, it's just the river. Everybody knows the river is the boundary. But there are armed soldiers on both sides of that river, and if you try to cross from Jordan to Israel, they will shoot you. If you cross from Israel to Jordan, they will shoot you. If you cross into Syria, you actually cannot, I'll get off this, but you cannot travel from Israel to the Arab countries around Israel. If you were to go onto Google Maps right now and get directions from Jerusalem to Amman, so Jerusalem, Israel, to Amman, Jordan, they would send you to Egypt and then around. You cannot actually travel from Israel to Jordan. And when you go to Israel, they don't stamp your visa. They don't stamp the visa in your passport. They give you a little piece of paper that you put inside your passport and you hope and pray you don't lose. Because that's your visa. Because if you have an Israeli visa stamp on your passport, you cannot enter the Arab countries around Israel. Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Syria, all of those countries will not. Egypt is the only country in that region that recognizes an Israeli visa stamp. And so this Mount Hermon is the border between Israel and Syria, always has been, always will be. Again, one of the weirdest things about it is that because so many of the Jews that live in Israel now came from Europe, if you drive up into the Golan Heights toward Mount Hermon, you will suddenly see a whole collection of Swiss chalets, which makes no sense until you realize the Jews that live there came from Switzerland. And they built these Swiss chalets and a ski resort on the edge of Mount Hermon. So Jesus is coming down from Syria, which in his day was a Roman province, down into the region of what's called Banias, what today we call the Golan Heights, which was ruled by one of the sons of Herod the Great, a guy named Philip the Tetrarch. That region is ruled by the Herodians, but it is mostly Greek. All right, so it's mostly Greeks that live in this area. And I say all that to give context as we begin in chapter 16, verse 13. When Jesus came into the district of, and I'm going to pronounce this the way everybody does, Caesarea Philippi. It's actually Caesarea Philippi, but nobody's going to know what I'm talking about. I know you guys are worried about that. But Caesarea Philippi, and he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, others Jeremiah, one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter replied, you are the Christ, or the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, which just means Simon, the son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are now Peter, And again, this is the Greek word, Petros. Jesus actually called him Kepha, is the Aramaic word, which means rock. I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. And then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. And from that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan, you are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? What shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done. And truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." Now, I'm going to focus mostly, I think the verses 21 on is pretty self-explanatory, but I want to focus on the context of what he's talking about in verses 13 through 20 and the situation that Jesus finds himself in as he goes here. I mentioned he was coming down from the Mount Hermon to this area called Benias. Benias is actually named for the Greek god Pan. All right, Greek Pan, you know, pan flute, half goat kind of guy, and he was the god of debauchery. He was related to Dionysus. It was he was the god of wine and drinking and partying, and therefore he was a very, very popular god. I mean, gods of partying tend to be very popular, and so there was a location that he is actually, Jesus is at, that I want to talk about so that you can understand the words that he says and what he's saying. This is a modern picture of what is called the Cave of Pan. I'm going to show you what it looked like in Jesus' day. But it is a cave. All right. But the cave actually has a spring, and that spring is one of the four sources of the Jordan River. This is about 3 miles from the biblical city of Dan. It was not populated in the pre-Roman world. So for thousands of years, there was no city here. And then around 200 BC or so, they built a city here around a shrine that they established around this cave. At some point, this cave became known as many different names, but one of the names that it was known as was the Cave of Pan, or the Gates of the Underworld, the Gates of Hades. And so when Jesus is talking in Caesarea Philippi, he's talking about coming to Caesarea Philippi. The city Caesarea Philippi was actually built around these caves. And so he probably, and I'm going to set the context, and I'll explain why I think this is happening. This is probably early in the morning, and Jesus is walking with his disciples. They come to the shut doors of the temple called the Panteon. And here's a reconstruction of what it would have looked like. This is actually built up against that cave that I just showed you. And it was secured and locked. There were doors that were locked. It's probably early in the morning. And Jesus is walking along the path by them. And he says to his disciples, "Who do men say that I am?" Now, I have to imagine they stopped for breakfast. So now this is me, just a little bit of divine sanctified imagination, right? They're always eating. Jesus tends to ask them questions when they're eating. And so he probably says to him, "Who do men say that I am?" And the disciples say, "Well, I mean, some people think that you're John the Baptist." And we read about that in chapter 14, that Herod Antipas thought that Jesus was John the Baptist raised again. Some people think that you're Elijah. Some people think that you're Jeremiah. And then they use this phrase that gets thrown away. And sometimes some people think you're one of the other prophets, and they mean the 12. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum. They're like one of those 12 nobody names. Like you're just one of the prophets, right? You're just one of them. And so he's sitting there and then he says to him, who do you say that I am? And Peter answers Jesus in an extraordinary way. So keep in mind that they're here. This is not a Jewish site. This is a Greek site. The city of Caesarea, this is another reconstruction. You kind of blow out a little bit. You can see that temple way in the back there. And Jesus would have come down around the road here, and he's having this conversation probably near the forum, which or the agora, the marketplace, which is right in front of Pan. And he says, who do people say that I am? And Jesus and Simon Peter says two things. He says, you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Mashiach, the anointed one. You are the Messiah, and he says, you are the Son of the living God. Now, that is a very important thing that people blow over all of the time when people teach about this. He's actually giving us two answers to that question. He's giving a Jewish answer, and he's giving a Gentile answer. Simon Peter says to Jesus, you are the Jewish Messiah, the Mashiach, the anointed one. So the son of David, the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies, all those things. But you are the son of the living God. Why is that so important? Well, Caesarea Philippi, not only did it have the Pantheon, it was one of the first places in the Eastern Mediterranean world where the imperial cult was taking on. The imperial cult was the worship of dead emperors, and eventually living emperors, but the worship of dead emperors as gods. What would happen is, when Julius Caesar died, whose real name is Julius Caesar, but Julius Caesar died, his son Octavian, who was ruling as Caesar Augustus, he said, I saw my father, actually his uncle who'd adopted him, but anyway, I saw my father ascend into the sky and become a star, and he started the worship of the what's called the Deus Julius, the divine Julius, that we're going to worship Julius Caesar as a god. And then when Caesar Augustus died, his stepson, all right, they're all, just call him a son, Tiberius, then said, I also saw my father, my predecessor, Augustus, become a star in the sky, and so we're going to worship the divine Augustus. We're going to worship. Now, Caesar Augustus actually kind of encouraged people to worship him while he was still alive. He kind of this funky, cunning little thing that he would do. But Tiberius said, oh, he's the... So the Romans worship, and it's very important that you understand, the Romans are led by whom? The son of the dead God. The God who was divine when he died. Julius Caesar died and he became a god. Here he was deified. Augustus died and he was made a god. And you had to worship him. Simon Peter says, you are the Messiah and the son of the living God. So the message is, not only are you the Jewish Messiah, but you are everything the Caesars claim to be. Augustus and Tiberius both claimed to be the saviors of the world. That was one of their titles. They claimed to be the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. They claimed all of the titles that you see attributed to Jesus in the Gospels. Simon Peter says, not only are you the Jewish Messiah, but you are very clearly everything the Romans need. You are everything the Gentiles need as well. That's why people had called Jesus the Messiah before. That's why when Jesus hears Simon say this, Jesus says, you are blessed, Simon. And I love that he throws his father's name in here, because his father's name is Jonah. And Jesus just told the Pharisees and the Sadducees that the only sign they would get would be the sign of... And what was Jonah's mission? It was to go to the Gentiles and tell them about God. So he says, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. You're living up to your namesake. You're living up to your father's namesake. You are willing to accept this. I have to imagine this came to Simon Peter's mind years later when he was approached by a Gentile to preach the gospel. And Simon Peter has one of the great moments in Scripture. God appears to him in a dream, tells him that what he makes clean will be clean. Simon Peter is approached by this Gentile. He goes to the guy's house. He walks through the door. Simon Peter walks through the door. He says, "You know who I am. You know that I should not be here. But let's get down to the Jesus business." He says, "As a Jew, I should be looking down on the Gentiles, but I know that Jesus is the Son of the living God." By the way, and this is an aside for those of you that are historically minded, if you're ever asked a question about when the Gospels were written, the fact that the Gospel of Matthew refers to the city of Caesarea Philippi is very specific. In 61 AD, Herod Agrippa II renamed the city after the living emperor as an act of worship, and it was called the Nereion, named after Nero. And so it took the name of Nero in 61 AD, which means that this must be written before that happened. And so Peter makes this confession to Jesus, and Jesus' response is to call him Kepha, or Peter, the rock. And this has led to a lot of confusion. All right? I mentioned I forgot to mention this. I should note this. He says to Peter, he says that my Father revealed this to you, not flesh and blood. He says you could only have known this if God had been speaking and you were listening. And so my Father revealed this to you. But Jesus then starts to talk about the church, and the verses here are used in many different ways. There are no fewer than 16 interpretations of these verses. And the most prominent, the most well-known one, is the idea that what Jesus is doing is he's establishing the hierarchy of the church. He's basically naming Simon Peter the first supreme pontiff, the first pope. The word pope, by the way, is not the title of that guy we call pope. It's just a version of Papa, Father, that it comes from Italian. His official title is the ecclesiastical bishop of the Church of Rome. But that's really hard to put on a postcard, so everybody just calls him Papa or Pope. But Jesus deals with the question of the church, and I think that if we just read what Jesus says, we can see some problems with the way that that's interpreted, saying that Peter is the first pope, kind of the church is a hierarchy. I'm going to unpack that a little bit. He says, "I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." The first question is, what is the rock? Some people said it's Peter. Peter himself denies this. In 1 Peter chapter 2, and you can verse it up, you can look it up, Peter actually says, he says, "We are living stones. We are all stones in a building built for God, and there is a cornerstone, and that cornerstone is Jesus." He says, "I'm not the rock," because people obviously had heard this reference, him being called Kepha, Petros, the rock. He says, "No, you're misunderstanding what I mean, what Jesus meant by that." Jesus was not talking about me being the foundation. He was talking about me being the first stone in the wall. Now, let me explain how you build foundations in the ancient world. First thing you do is you get a cornerstone, and that cornerstone is built very specifically to have exactly a 90-degree angle on one of its sides. And never let anybody tell you that the ancients were not good at engineering. They knew what a 90-degree angle was. They knew how to make one. And they knew how to build buildings square, which says more than some of the contractors I've dealt with in my life. They knew how to build a building square. And what they would do is they would cut that cornerstone. And that cornerstone would be taken to the site. They would prepare the site. And then they would lay that cornerstone down at exactly the position they wanted everything to radiate from. Now you say, well, shouldn't they have had four cornerstones? No, too expensive. And with some simple math, you can actually get all four corners from that one corner. So what you do is you stretch a string from that one corner to where you want the opposite corner of the building to be. You measure the diagonal, which Pythagoras told us, c squared equals a squared plus b squared, All right. Some of you are like, what? Now he's doing algebra. I'm not really. I just have my computer do it. But they would stretch that. And then if that line was straight, you could then measure equidistant from those two points to get your other two corners and then the long side. And then what you would do, you stretch to second string. And then you just moved those strings until all four segments of those strings were exactly the same length and you had a square building. But then you had to lay the rocks. The first rock was the most important one. You had your cornerstone. But if that first rock was not big enough, or that first rock was not round enough, flat enough, or that first rock wasn't stable enough to set the vector for the rest of that wall, the building was still going to be wobbly. And so Jesus says to him, and I picture Jesus having breakfast with the disciples. Who do you say that I am? Simon Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus looks over to the foundation of the Panaeon, the building that's right there, that's a rectangular temple built with the best of Greek, I almost said German engineering, it's a BMW now, best of Greek Roman engineering. He says, you're the rock. That confession, that's the first rock. That's what I'm going to build my church off of. Not Jesus is the Christ. People were already calling him the Christ, but that he was the Christ and the Son of the living God. Those two things together, the universal message of the gospel. And then Simon Peter himself says, I'm not the cornerstone. I'm just the rock. I'm just a rock in the wall. I'm going to come back to that. But then Jesus says, upon this rock, right, what does he say he will build? I will build the church. Is that what he says? He says, I will build my church. Now, the Greek word, ekklesia there, which is distinguished from synagogue, which is a synagogue, a Jewish synagogue, it doesn't necessarily mean a hierarchy. In fact, the only other place that word is used in Matthew is in Matthew 18, where he talks about relationships and resolving conflict. This is a primarily relational word, not a hierarchical word. What does that mean? It means this is more focused on how we connect to one another and not on how somebody bosses us around and tells us how to operate our religion. He is saying to Simon Peter, upon this rock I will build the relationships of all the living stones. That's how Peter reads it in 1 Peter. That we're gonna build the relationships of everybody that's going to be the house that I'm building. You following with me so far? Then he says, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Now remember, what is the Panaeon built against? It's built against this cave. What was the cave called? Gates of Hades. So he says, you see the foundations? This is the rock. I'm going to build a rock. I'm going to build a building. I'm going to build a living house, a temple to my own glory. I'm the cornerstone. You're the rocks. See those, that gate of hell? That's not going to prevail against it. And then he says something that I think it really got me thinking. He says, and I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. And man, this verse causes problems for people. It caused a problem for me as I was reading it. You want to guess what the problem was? Did the Romans have keys? That's where my brain went on this. I'm like, what is it? Is he really talking about like a key? I was actually surprised to discover that as far back as the 400s, and the Egyptians were doing it in wood, but the Romans were doing it in metal, they were actually making locks, like padlocks and door locks and things. And you would have a key. And you would put the key in the lock and it would move the tumblers and the thing would open. That blew my mind. I don't know what I thought. I guess I thought the Romans just tied everything. They're like, I'm a complicated knot. Nobody's going to get my house. and walk away. But they actually made keys. They made lots of keys. They looked a lot like skeleton keys, and we found thousands of them. All right, they're all over the place. And so it's like, well, then, you know, Jesus says you have the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Well, a lot of people take that to say, well, then Peter was the first pope. Peter was appointed to be the head of the church. Okay? Now, there's a lot of problems with that biblically. For one thing, Peter is actually submitted to the authority of James. Nobody ever says James is the first pope because he was in Jerusalem. And then Simon Peter actually gets resisted and opposed by Paul. So there's a lot of issues with that argument that Peter was the first pope. It might surprise you to know, by the way, that idea as a cardinal doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church only extends to the 1600s. That prior to that, it was one of many views held in the Catholic Church. In fact, Desiderius Erasmus, who was one of the most brilliant minds that's ever lived, actually considered it a ridiculous idea. Saint Augustine, right, who was the foundation of Catholic doctrine in the 4th century, Augustine actually said, well, this is one idea, but there's some others. He actually supported some other positions. What happened was, during the Middle Ages, anytime you got frustrated with a pope, you just called him Antichrist and you made your own pope. And then Martin Luther came along, and Martin Luther just started calling Pope Leo X the Antichrist. I mean, he actually wrote a book called The Antichrist, which was subtitled, Hey, Leo is the pope, but he's Antichrist. Kind of like, it was very clear. Martin Luther, by the way, was a biting satirist. He's worth reading just because of how snarky he is. It's in German, so you miss some of the snark, but he's still there. I mean, what is German? It's like, you are not very handsome, you know. That was a terrible German accent. Don't do that again. I don't know what that was. I was like going for Schwarzenegger, and I wound up with Dolph Lundgren. But this idea was, and then Martin Luther started calling them, and so they had this thing called the Counter-Reformation, where the Catholic theologians all basically rewrote their history and argued that Peter was the first pope, and this is what you need to believe. Peter doesn't take it that way. I've already mentioned that. This is just a little note if you ever worried about this question. The Gospel of Mark, which is generally considered to be the Gospel of Peter, avoids this conversation altogether. It's almost like Mark didn't want people to think, and Peter didn't want people to think that this meant he was the head of the church. But there were keys in the ancient world. That sent me down a huge rabbit hole. And now you get to go with me. So what happened with the temple? Remember, they're next to the Pantheon, all right? The temple to Pan. He's already pointed at the foundations. He said, you are the rock. And then he's talked about the gates of hell will not prevail against them. And then he says, I'm going to give you the key to the kingdom of heaven. Well, here's what happened in Greco-Roman temples. A slave was entrusted with the key. Now, what happened was, at the end of the day, when all the worship and stuff was done, you closed the big doors in front of the temple, and they had an automatic bolt lock that would lock from the inside. And only that slave had the key that would unlock the door. No one else could get into the temple. There was nobody in the temple. Nobody lived in their temples. No one else lived in the temple. The keys looked a lot like these two things. We don't know exactly what the key to the Pantheon looks like. This is a simpler one on the left. This is a key for a, if you guys are taking notes, a Laconian lock. All right, named after Laconia, not northern New Hampshire, central New Hampshire. Laconia is the region around Sparta in Greece. This is a simpler one. The one to the right is a much more complicated one. Each lock and key was made unique. There were no spare copies of the keys. And what would happen is that slave, to begin the day, would come in. And these things are like this big. We're not talking like it's in his pocket, right? Jangling, you know, the janitors coming around opening all the temples. I can't find the key for the Pantheon. All right, this one slave had this one lock, one key, and he would come at the beginning of the day and nobody could get in to celebrate that God until that slave stuck the key in the door, reached it down, pulled the latch, and the doors opened. What you will bind on earth will be bound. What you loose on earth will be loosed. But you are not an authority. You're my servant. And your job is not to restrict who goes and comes and goes in the kingdom of God, but to open the door for all. See, that's what this means. When Jesus says to him, I give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, he says, the gates of hell, they're always open, but they're not going to win. Because I'm giving you the keys to open the doors, to invite all of the nations to come to me. I'm giving you the authority, not over people, but over this little doodad that's going to open the door. And I'm giving you the opportunity to open the doors of the kingdom of God to all mankind. Now, if you read the book of Acts, that is exactly what Simon Peter does. When the church said you had to be a Jew in order to follow Jesus, Simon Peter shows up and says, I know what you're saying, but Jesus said this is open to all. He's the one who loosens the doors for all mankind to hear the gospel. Now, Jesus sees that coming. Jesus says to Simon Peter, you're going to do this. Of course, and I don't have time, but the next verse confuses me to no end, because as soon as they make this, Jesus says, don't tell anybody. Here's my big idea for today. It is Christ's kingdom. We just have the privilege of opening the doors. It is Christ's kingdom. We just have the privilege of opening the doors. We are just the slaves. The David said, I would rather be the doorkeeper in the house of the Lord. He says, I would rather be the slave that opens the doors of the house of the Lord than to have all the wealth and power and glory for myself. Jesus says to Simon Peter, your job is to open the door. You let people come, be open, just open the door. They come or they go. It's not your job to decide who's in and who's out. You just open the door. And is there a better way to express what the church's purpose is than to say our job is just to open the door? To say, come on in, the door is open. Come on in and see the kingdom. People are going to be going for the gates of hell because the gates of hell are cool. You get to do all kinds of fun. I didn't even really talk about this, but the gates of hell and the Pantheon, there was all kinds of fun stuff you could do. There was a swimming pool. I'm not making this up. There was a swimming pool. There were these little niches on the rocks that you could climb up the rock and put a little statue of whatever, whoever you were praying for. They had daily drinking parties. I mean, there was a lot of attraction to the gates of hell. It was cool, man. But Jesus says, you open the door because, and I think this is important, heaven does not compete with hell. Let me say that again. Heaven does not compete with hell. Our job as the church is not to be cooler and more attractive or as cool and as attractive as the world. Sin, like the dark side, will always be seductive. It will always look more fun. It will always be more appealing. That's why all we can do is open the door. When we start trying to make the church appealing to people who are not willing to follow Christ, we make the church a lot less like Christ. and a lot more like the gates of hell. How are you going to open the doors to the kingdom in the lives of those around you today, tomorrow, the day after? How can you accept your responsibility as a key holder, as the slave who opens the door, and balance that with your desire to either kick the people you don't like out and kick the people you like in, and instead simply be the doorkeeper, simply be the guy that opens the door, the woman that opens the door and says, come and see who Jesus is. Come and see who he is. And that's one of the reasons, and I'm gonna close here, that's one of the reasons why we as a congregation, we don't set a high bar of whether you can come and worship with us. We believe that you, on every level of your spiritual journey, should be able to come in. You should, the doors should be open. Now, I will be perfectly honest with you. We don't intend you to stay where you are. We will not say, come in and however you live your life is all right with us. We are not going to pretend that we don't believe in sin. We're not going to pretend that we don't believe that some of the things that we human beings do is in direct opposition to the will and created order of God. And we make no apologies for what we believe. But we will not slam the door in anyone's face. Because the gospel is not only to the Jew, he is not only the Jewish Messiah, he is the Son of the living God. Would you join me in a word of prayer?